Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mitt Romney's verbal broadside against Donald Trump today, in which he urged Rubio and Cruz's supporters to vote for Kasich in Ohio and Cruz and Kasich's supporters to vote for Rubio in Florida to stop Trump's momentum towards the Republican nomination. Patricia Mazzei, a political writer for the Miami Herald who has covered Florida's congressional and state legislative politics, joins us to discuss how Romney's strategy could be employed in Florida, where Trump is ahead of Rubio in the polls. But although Kasich is not a factor, if Cruz's votes went to Rubio, then Rubio might just beat Trump and avoid a campaign-ending humiliation on March the 15th. Then, with Romney calling Trump a fraud and a con man whose promises are as worthless as a diploma from Trump University, we will look into Romney's investments in predatory for-profit colleges and Rubio's defense of the most fraudulent for-profit college, Corinthian, that ripped off the taxpayer for over $6 billion. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, joins us to discuss Romney and Rubio's hypocrisy and whether desperate efforts by the Republican establishment to stop Trump are too little, too late. Then finally, we'll examine the charges by NATO's Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Breedlove, that Russia is, quote, deliberately weaponizing migration in an attempt to overwhelm European structures and break European resolve through indiscriminate bombing of civilians in Syria to get the refugees on the road and make them a problem for someone else. A former Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, Anders Aslund, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss how Putin is cynically stoking the refugee crisis in Syria to destabilize Europe in the hope of weakening EU sanctions against Russia. And joining us now is Patricia Mazzei, who is a political writer for the Miami Herald, who has covered Florida's congressional and state legislative politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patricia Mazzei.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've had, of course, a lot of schoolyard taunts and insults traded between Donald Trump and Marco Rubio about wet pants, small penises, and putting on makeup with a trowel, sweating, etc. It's all been rather disgraceful, in fact. But now you've got an even bigger spat, if you will, with name-calling between Mitt Romney and Donald Trump, Romney calling Trump a con artist and Trump calling Romney a choke artist. So,
lots of artists.
Exactly. So this thing is really getting out of hand. But the one piece of substantive advice, if you will, that Mitt Romney offered in his attack on Donald Trump today was he urged the Republicans to somehow to find a way to vote for Kasich in Ohio and Rubio in Florida. So how could that work out with, one, Rubio's behind Trump in the polls, and two, how could you get Kasich's supporters and Cruz's supporters to vote for Rubio in Florida?
It is a difficult scenario that Mitt Romney laid out, and you'll notice he didn't go into specifics and didn't pick make an endorsement or pick a candidate, right? He was just, just delivering an anti-Trump message more broadly and kind of warning the party to figure something out. Now, what that is, nobody really knows. Would it involve some kind of unity ticket, someone dropping out for the good of the order? I mean, at this point, we just can't see that happening. Not when you have Ted Cruz having won his home state of Texas and Rubio and Kasich both competing for their home states of Florida and Ohio. So we have not seen in Florida a big campaign effort from Kasich, any effort at all, really. And the Wall Street Journal reported earlier today that it sounded like he might not be heading this way. We have not gotten confirmation from either he or Senator Cruz about whether they plan to campaign here. Cruz has been in Florida before raising money, and he had an event in Orlando a few months ago. But generally, I think they were waiting to see if this was going to turn into a Jeb Bush-Marco Rubio fight. And now that Jeb Bush is out and Donald Trump is on the rise, I'm not sure how much money they're going to invest here. This is a very expensive state to campaign in. There are 12 distinct media markets, and this is not a place where you can meet everybody in person, right? You have to just go on TV either with ads or as Trump does with lots of TV interviews. So I have not seen any signs on the ground here in Florida that that will have a heavily contested race beyond Trump and Rubio. But, of course, that could change in the coming days.
So what are the numbers? How is Cruz polling in Florida?
Well, Cruz is generally polling third. So he hasn't been, I mean, depending on the poll, if he were to drop out and all of his support were to go to Rubio, then Rubio would top Trump in some of the polls. There are other polls that show kind of a bigger gap between Trump and Rubio, as much as 20 percentage points. Now, this is a closed primary in Florida, which means that independents can't vote, and only people registered with each of the parties, Republican or Democratic, can participate. Generally, we've seen that that means Trump's numbers tend to come down a little bit because he draws from a lot of independents and Democrats who in this case would not be able to cast a ballot for him. And so when we see polls that just look at registered Republicans who have voted in past elections, Trump's lead over Rubio is about, you know, 7 or 8%. And certainly if Rubio were to get all of Cruz's support, he would top that. But again, we have seen when other candidates have dropped out, it's not that simple to reallocate their supporters to other candidates. They tend to split up.
Well, my understanding is also that Trump has a pretty good relationship with Governor Rick Scott, who all but endorsed him in a USA Today column published in January. So what role is the governor playing? And there's also a rumor that Trump has promised Rick Scott a VP slot.
Well, just today, the governor said he was not going to endorse anybody. He wrote a Facebook post this afternoon and said he is going to stay out of the Republican race. Now, as you noted, he wrote this column in USA Today in January that was glowing about Mr. Trump. And the rumor here in Florida was that the governor was getting ready to endorse Mr. Trump either Tuesday when the Super Tuesday results were out and Trump was at Mar-a-Lago, his estate in Palm Beach. That didn't happen. Or that there could be a forthcoming endorsement in person on Saturday when Trump holds a rally in Orlando. But the governor definitively said that's not going to happen. He's just going to watch the race and let the voters decide. He said he trusts the voters of Florida. Normally, you would expect a sitting Republican governor to back his sitting U.S. senator for President Rubio in this case. But Rick Scott was an anti-establishment figure when he was first elected in 2010. He probably remembers how much it hurt to have other Republicans endorsing his rival at the time. And I don't think he wants to get that involved in this race. I mean, he's already kind of said his piece and not backed Rubio. But Rubio's supporters were really concerned that Scott would go for Trump because even though Scott has never been hugely popular, he did win two elections here, and the sitting governor's endorsement is always going to give somebody a bump, however small or however short, and Trump would have certainly used it to kind of rub it in Rubio's face and said, look, your own governor won't back you. So his sitting out might be helpful to Rubio. It might also be helpful to Scott for his future political ambitions if he wants to run for U.S. Senate himself in 2018, as he is rumored to want to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Patricia Mazzei, who's a political writer for the Miami Herald, who has covered Florida's congressional and state legislative politics. So Rubio, though, is now spending all of his time, I believe, in Florida. I think he's campaigning in Puerto Rico over the weekend, but he's basically making his last stand, as far as I can tell, in Florida, facing a possible humiliating and campaign-ending loss there with Trump leading in the polls. And as we've discussed earlier, whatever advice Mitt Romney was offering today amongst his takedown of Donald Trump, it's very hard to employ that kind of mechanism of how do you actually get Cruz's, and you said the Kasich supporters down in Florida are negligible to begin with. So that notwithstanding, what kind of chances does Rubio have to make up for this gap in the polls?
Well, he certainly knows how to win Florida. He won in 2010, and he was, as he has noted, the underdog in the primary race that year. He took on the sitting governor, Charlie Crist, and muscled him out of the race for U.S. Senate. His campaign has said, you know, in no uncertain terms, he has said himself he will win Florida. They say they know how to do this. This is a state where voting has been happening already for weeks by mail and started this week in person early voting. So you would assume that when they talk about knowing how to campaign here, that means they have been calling voters who registered for absentee ballots to implore them to mail them in, to go to the polls early, to not leave everything to election day. He is going to be in Jacksonville on Saturday, and we do expect to see a lot more of him in Miami. Obviously, he was here on Super Tuesday and gave an entirely Florida-centric speech looking forward to March 15th. I mean, it is his last stand, and if he can pull it off, then he can show that he can come from behind to beat Trump against what the polls have shown so far. But it is going to be a lift because Trump has such wide name recognition and expansive support, because Florida is usually a reflection of the rest of the nation. I mean, our state looks a lot like the rest of the country. The Southeast is like the Northeast. The North is like the South. The Midwest is like the Southwest of the state. So usually, as the nation goes, so goes Florida, which is why it's the country's largest swing state. If he can do it, it'll be a remarkable political feat, just to hold on to his home state and live to fight another day.
So is there any residual bitterness about the breakup between the protege and the mentor, with Governor Bush having really helped Rubio's career and then, I believe, felt quite betrayed by him when he ran? And then, of course, during some of the debates, there was some animus expressed between the two of them. And I don't think there's any question. As there were even some rumors that Jeb Bush was going to dump a bunch of opposition research on Rubio's opponents. So in terms of the electorate, is there any residual bitterness about Rubio's break with Jeb Bush, who I believe is still quite popular in the state?
There is among some Bush supporters who felt particularly hurt by Rubio's entry into the race. And they have decided to kind of stay on the sidelines and not move to Rubio. That doesn't mean that they're supporting anybody else, like Trump, necessarily. It's just that they, you know, they're kind of still licking their wounds and in mourning over Bush's the end of Bush's candidacy. We have seen many more Florida Republicans turn to Rubio and kind of say, you know, we're turning the page. We really liked Governor Bush. He didn't make it. Some campaigns don't make it. And now we're turning to the next best thing. Whether Governor Bush himself has any resentment towards Rubio, you know, it's hard to say. He's got advisors, former advisors from both sides, some who will tell him you really have to endorse Marco and move on, and others who say, you know, wait, because you don't want to use your political capital on a guy who might not win Florida. So, you know, you kind of hear mixed reviews from the two camps within Bush universe, and Bush himself hasn't said how he feels. He said throughout the campaign that, you know, this wasn't personal, that they were still friends. And we'll have to see in the coming days if that pans out into an endorsement or if he just sits this one out.
So how is Rubio doing, though, in his new amped-up campaign, you know, facing the wall here, all or nothing in Florida? I mean, he hasn't been able to strike a balance between the serious and the silly. But, you know, calling out Trump about wet pants and small penises was not a high moment by any standards. But on the other hand, he does make these impassioned speeches about the need to build up our defenses and his foreign policy prescriptions, etc., that he offers up in, you know, almost like machine gun style. But he nevertheless, some people find him quite credible in that regard. But on the other hand, he seems to undercut himself lately by trying to enter the schoolyard brawl with Donald Trump.
Well, I think that was a calculated move by the campaign to try to change things up on the days ahead of Super Tuesday and try to compete toe-to-toe with Trump on what they call earned media coverage, right, which is not advertising but actually time on cable news networks. And they have devoted so much time to Trump that this was a way that they thought, well, maybe we can compete for some of the attention, because, you know, they had to campaign in so many states at the same time. They couldn't be in all of them physically. So they thought, well, maybe if we get some TV time. And this was a way to do it, by showing a candidate who could land a few punches and be more unpredictable. Because one of the reasons the networks like to, the cable networks show Trump is because you never really know what he's going to say. It's not your typical stump speech. And it seemed to work for Rubio in terms of just getting more media coverage. You even saw Cruz and Kasich kind of drowned out by this. But it may have been too late to move the numbers for Super Tuesday. I mean, we saw some exit polling that suggested that people who were deciding late were deciding against Trump, and in some cases for Rubio, but not in all of the cases. And he didn't, win, other than Minnesota, didn't win a state on Tuesday. So either it was too late or not enough, or people preferred his optimistic speech. I mean, it's hard to kind of measure a single factor here. So he kind of toned it down a little bit. Since Tuesday, we have heard Rubio still hitting Trump, but kind of on a more substantive basis and taking a more serious tone about, okay, we were joking about it, but this is a real challenge for the Republican Party. We'll see in the debate tonight which of the two tacks he goes for.
Well, I think his disadvantage has been that he's a first-term senator, a backbencher, and he's running for president. Now, of course, certainly Barack Obama broke that mold, but he's been criticized for not being ready. So gravitas is something that he needs and he's tried to earn. But making those kind of silly comments about Trump and entering the sort of schoolyard arena of this brawl with Trump clearly undercut that effort, didn't it?
Well, I'm not sure we can say that yet. I mean, no one has known how to take on Trump. The Republican primary season is littered with, the candidates who tried and failed and had to end their campaign. So this was a new tack. And we don't know, had he not tried it, if he wouldn't have even won Minnesota. I mean, in retrospect, there will be a lot of writing and analysis and study to do of the 2016 Republican presidential primary. But whether Rubio was undercut, I'm not sure anyone can say that, because had he not tried it, maybe things would have been worse for him on Super Tuesday.
So given that he's pulling out all the stops, what kind of help is he getting from this new PAC that's formed called Our Principles, that largely funded by a hedge fund billionaire, Singer? My understanding is that they're using a lot of media in Florida to boost Rubio and to attack Trump.
They have unveiled a few television ads against Trump that bring up some of his business dealings in the past, some of his business failures. We just saw a new ad today by one of the anti-Trump groups that brought up, for example, the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, they mentioned the developer of that tower who ended up in court, and a bunch of people were left, investors were left without their money. I mean, so we're going to see a ramp up of people bringing up things that have been written about Trump and have been in the public record for years, but that his rivals haven't really managed to drive home to any of the Trump supporters. I mean, none of that has sunk in yet. And because Florida voting started already weeks ago, it's unclear how much of an effect this is going to have leading up to March 15th. I mean, they would really have to blanket the airwaves because, people need to listen to a message 10 times before it sinks in. So I'm not sure that the barrage will be enough. The New York Times reported today that Trump plans to have his own ads on TV. We haven't seen any of those yet. So far, all that people are seeing is anti-Trump.
Well, they probably saw Romney, though, didn't they? So I don't think that was a pretty big hit that Trump got today.
Well, except it's not a TV ad. Perhaps someone will cut it into a TV ad. But unless you were watching cable news at work, you might have to catch up with that later.
Right. Well, that's probably my problem. I watch too much of the stuff. Anyway, Patricia, I'm very grateful you joined us, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Patricia Mazzei, who's a political writer for the Miami Herald, who's covered Florida's congressional and state legislative politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Mitt Romney's investments in predatory for-profit colleges following his charges that Trump's promises are worthless as a diploma from Trump University.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clouds. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my usual flair.
Your destination called
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining me now is David Halpin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpin.
Thank you, Ian.
And today has been quite a slugfest on television between the former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who ran for president in 2012 and, of course, failed to defeat President Barack Obama. He lambasted Trump earlier today, calling him a phony and a fraud, and accusing him of playing the American people for suckers and saying that Trump's promises were as worthless as a degree from Trump University. I take it your feeling is that at least a degree from Trump University, I'm not even sure they issued any degrees, but if they did, they were perhaps were worthless. But at least they weren't on the taxpayers' dime, were they, like these for-profit colleges that both Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio support?
That's right. Trump University was unaccredited and unlicensed. And part of what happened was New York State found out about it and said, stop doing this. And Trump University said, okay. And then they just kept on doing it. They ignored them. So Trump University, totally fraudulent operation, a scam that maybe some people learned something from, but they lied in so many ways that we can talk through it. But the for-profit college that Marco Rubio went to bat for with the government and said, please go light on, was the notorious Corinthian Colleges, which was taking $1.4 billion of our tax money in the form of student aid. And Mitt Romney not only went to bat for this industry, he was an investor in this industry. And both of them took enormous campaign contributions and have taken from this industry as well. The licensed for-profit colleges, the accredited ones that are entitled to federal aid in that industry, $32 billion a year of our tax money goes to for-profit colleges, many of them behaving in the predatory way that Trump University behaved in.
So I guess the word hypocrisy comes to mind.
Well, the lunacy. I think that the Republican voters have a choice here between two visions of country club Republicanism. One is the kind of looting that Mitt Romney was famous for at Bain Capital, where they took over companies and basically their objective was to make money for Bain Capital rather than for anybody associated with a company or the workers of the community. Or Trump, which is about pyramid schemes and straight-up fraud. Trump, you know, some of the things besides Trump University that he did, timeshares that were a ripoff. He was the spokesman for RCN, a pyramid scheme selling fake phone services. And often he'd have a legitimate business, but then what he did with it was, say, a building project, he didn't pay a lot of his contractors what he agreed to pay them. So I think these are the visions that are the Republican Party and voters have to choose between. Sounds wonderful to me.
Well, yes, it's a choice between buccaneers and predators, I guess.
Yeah.
So what's then the moral outrage, the tone that Romney tried to project today? I take it the problem is that the Republican establishment is trying to stop Trump, probably too late, but they are obviously quite desperate. But is Romney the best they can do? I can imagine George W. Bush is not going to work because his brother ran. That not exactly makes him particularly credible. Is Romney the best spokesperson that the Republican establishment can muster up at this point?
Well, it's just complete chaos. They don't know what they're doing. And for weeks, people have been saying, you know, people have to get out of the race so they can get down to one person taking on Trump. And I've been saying for the same amount of time, that's wrong. And finally, other people are starting to agree with me. If there's any chance to beat Trump, it's a very narrow chance. Kasich, Rubio, Cruz have to stay in the race. They have to win their home states. They have to try to win other states. But if any of them drop out, some of their support will go to Trump, and Trump will actually have a better chance of getting a majority of delegates before the convention. And last night I heard Al Hunt say that, and today I heard Mitt Romney say it. So I do think that makes sense. And you know, to me, none of these Republicans are any good for the country, in my view, none of the ones who are still in the race. But Trump is a threat and an offense of a different order of magnitude because he is narcissistic, autocratic, disrespectful of things like civil liberties and freedom in our country, talked about doing more than waterboarding, disrespectful of women and people of color and disabled. So I think it is a much worse threat, and I do not identify with Mitt Romney. I see him as a hypocrite. He doesn't really share the values of most Americans, but anything to try to slow down Trump, I think is a good thing.
So in terms of the forces now allayed against Trump, which may be too little too late, but they do seem to be fairly, I mean, I've never heard Romney speak so bluntly. And I understand there's also the hedge fund billionaire Singer has put
Paul
up.
Singer.
Yeah, Paul Singer. He's put up some money into a PAC called Our Principles that I believe the former communications guy for Jeb Bush is running. And they're going to blanket these states with ads. So what's your sense? A part of me thinks, David, that this is going to backfire and just absolutely make Trump supporters dig in further, because it furthers the narrative that Trump's been putting out there, that the establishment have sold you out, they're useless, they're in a panic. And, you know, the fact that they're ganging up on him now might well cause Trump supporters to circle the wagons.
I agree. It's a Hail Mary, but if they don't do it, I think surely Trump will win. I don't think just sitting back. And it's interesting that, you know, it is because of Citizens United that unlimited money can be spent now on these campaigns. So that means that it is these guys, his foes, even if they don't win, won't run out of money. So they can all be sort of kept on life support as they try to defeat Trump in these states. But it does involve the willing cooperation of all three men, Kasich, Cruz, and Rubio, who may realize that even if they stop Trump, there's not that much of a chance that any one of them will be the nominee. I mean, at best, there's a 1 in 3 chance, and there's also a chance they would turn to somebody like Paul Ryan or Romney. So they're going to have to be used as props, and that may show. And I do think it's going to be very hard to beat Trump. I mean, all the time I'm on social media, and all these people are, you know, the Trump people come out. They're angry. They're sick of things that happen in this country and happen to them, and they're sick of a landscape of shut down strip malls and shut down mills and factories. We have let down the middle class, the working class in this country, but it does not follow to me that the solution is a person of the low moral caliber and low level of knowledge as Donald Trump.
So what exactly, though, is the strategy? For example, Kasich in Ohio. How does he take Ohio and deny Trump? Does that mean that he's going to go to Cruz and Rubio and they're all going to agree that Cruz and Rubio are going to say vote for Kasich, and the opposite would happen down in Florida where Cruz and Kasich would say vote for Rubio?
No, I think it's that they don't attack Trump, and the others all just, I mean, they don't attack each other. They attack Trump, and they go out and do the best they can. If, you know, if Kasich, in the winner-take-all state, Kasich just needs to beat Trump. And the fact that Cruz and Rubio are still in the race, people don't need to vote. All those people don't need to give their votes to Kasich. He just needs to beat Trump. And I just don't think you're going to get that level of collusion. It would look ridiculous. But you know, maybe they might put fewer resources. Rubio might say, I'm going to focus on Florida. Kasich and ads and things like that. And Kasich says, I'm going to focus on Ohio, and then maybe I'll try Michigan. But the truth is, outside of Ohio, and even in Ohio, maybe in some polls, Trump is winning in all of them. So I don't know that this can be done. What's horrifying is how many people now see Trump as the solution to their problems. And frankly, it goes beyond the people voting in the Republican primary. A lot of Democrats, too. I hate to say it. I tend to try to not be too negative about the people in our country. But I think in a lot of ways, you know, we've dumbed down our culture. We watch terrible TV shows and just have sort of this awful sort of cultural background to what we do. And we've actually reached the point where we're in a horrible, horrible movie where stupidity is reigning, because there's no logical or reasonable case for Trump. There's a reasonable case for some of the things he's saying, like trade deals are bad for our country. But the solution cannot be a person who doesn't understand policy and who clearly has severe, severe mental health issues.
And, of course, you're almost referring there, David Halpin, to the movie Idiocracy.
Yes.
So is there, an awareness on the Democratic side that somehow that a lot of the Democrats are gleeful at the prospect of Trump running? But you've got to be careful what you wish for, right? We don't know the extent to which there is so much populist anger out there on the right that he could actually – do you think he could defeat a Hillary Clinton?
Yes. And I don't think that I don't think, frankly, that Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee. I think Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee. And I think if they were at one point gleeful, they're not anymore. Then it's not to say they're panicking, but they're serious about it. Because there are Democrats across the country that see something in Trump and are tired of the establishment. And Hillary Clinton, for all her good values, is the establishment. And it is just, you know, Trump is tapping into something. But again, he's a con artist, and I'm disappointed in my fellow Americans who agree with him. The only people who really are not being fooled by Trump, I think, are the bigots, because he's playing to bigotry. He obviously has some residual bigotry from his upbringing, and they get that this is their best chance to have a racist, divisive, anti-immigrant, sexist president. So that, I think, those people are not being fooled. But everybody else who's saying, well, I'm not racist, like a guy just said to me on my Facebook page, I'm not racist, but, you know, we need to do something here. Well, why are you electing someone who is, you know, spouting racism?
So given that this is the year of the outsider and that status quo politicians are in trouble across the board, and that Bernie Sanders has been doing well against Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton wants to improve the system, whereas Bernie Sanders wants to change the system. And that, of course, is also the appeal that Trump has, that he wants to throw, well, in his case, he's going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But what's your sense then of how much Hillary Clinton can re-engineer her campaign? She certainly seems to be improving a little bit in her, as you know her very well, but I'm told that she's in person, she's quite a charming and nice woman. But on the stump, she's a bit like Al Gore. She's a bit of a stiff. So do you think she's able to overcome that, to be more natural? And more importantly, borrow from Bernie Sanders and start talking about how the system is broken and it has to be changed?
I think she has borrowed some of that. It is hard to overcome, you know, that she's not as good a performer as the last two Democratic presidents, Obama and her husband. But I also think that, you know, she's become a rich person, a creature of, you know, hanging with rich people, knowing rich people, taking money and doing charitable endeavors with rich people. She's kind of in that world of entitlement. As great a person as I believe she is and is capable a person, she has become a creature of that world. And I think that she has to get in touch with channel and convey, you know, more of her connections to her roots as coming from not, you know, an overly affluent background and participating in all kinds of struggles in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that were sort of cultural struggles that helped define where we are now. That is a hard thing to overcome, that she's become like that, and to convey to people that she understands their problem and wants to help them. But I mean, it's an urgent thing, and you know, I'm not fully satisfied right now with Clinton or Sanders is exactly the person I want to lead the country. But the Republican nominee is almost surely going to be Trump, or if it's somebody like Ted Cruz, equally unacceptable. When you look at right now the fights in the Supreme Court over something like these horribly restrictive, you know, completely sinister state abortion laws meant to take away a woman's right to choose, the Democrats, you know, it's urgent that they win this election, because our whole future does hang in the balance. And there, in some ways, the Democrats are like the Republicans in the ways that corporations dominate Washington and policy, but in other fundamental ways, there's a huge difference.
Well, just in closing then, David Halpin, do you think in this spat between Romney and Trump, and of course Trump has fired back saying that Romney's a choke artist, and of course Romney did introduce Donald Trump at Las Vegas rather awkwardly in his campaign where Trump endorsed him, and Trump's now saying that he practically begged and got down on his knees for that endorsement. I'm sure that could be used as a video clip. What's your, in the final sense, who do you think is going to win this spat?
As a choke artist versus a con artist competition, at this point the con artist has the upper hand, and I think that may take them through a very gullible and very contemptible, frankly, population of voters who are deciding who's going to be the Republican nominee. And I'm hopeful in the general election, the good sense of the American people and very hard work to make sure that people get the urgency and get the vote out, that the con artist will at last be vanquished, at least for 4 years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halpin.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpin as a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the charges by NATO's Supreme Allied Commander in Europe that Russia is deliberately weaponizing the refugee crisis in Syria.
Your parents well, the children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and a Democracy, and his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much.
And the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander General Philip Breedlove, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee a couple of days ago, and he made the charge that Russia and Syria are weaponizing the refugee crisis to destabilize Europe, and specifically, just to quote General Breedlove, together Russia and the Assad regime are deliberately weaponizing migration in an attempt to overwhelm European structures and break European resolve. And I imagine when he refers to European resolve, that would be European resolve over the collective sanctions against Russia for its annexation of Crimea and invasion of eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, I fear that you are right, and this sounds utterly plausible, the whole thing. What we are seeing is that President Putin seems to be using all means to destabilize his neighborhood, and previously it was the former Soviet Union. Now he's going further, both into the Middle East and trying to destabilize Europe as well.
So there has been a concurrent with Russia's intervention in Syria, the refugee flows seem to increase. They were for the longest time largely staying in huge camps, mostly in Turkey and also in Jordan. But I believe it was the entrance of the Russians that precipitated the greater flow, but the flow was happening before then. So what's your understanding on of when the Russian military action in Syria precipitated a flow?
Well, of course, there has been a flow, as you say, all the time, and also in Lebanon, so all together in the region, in these three countries, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, there was about 5 million refugees to begin with, that is, in last summer. And then on the 30th of September, Russia started bombing the western part of Syria. That was largely held by groups that were allied with the West. And then these were relatively peaceful areas. So then people started fleeing. Obviously, being in Western Syria, they fled to the north, to Turkey, through Greece, up through the Balkans, and mainly to Germany. And secondly, to my home country, Sweden. Sweden took 160,000 refugees last year, which is 1.6% of the population in one single year. Germany took about 1 million, which is 1.3% of the German population. So these were massive flows, and clearly Russia wanted to get the flows going more in order to destabilize Europe, strengthen the right-wing anti-immigration parties in Europe that receive financial support from Russia, and force the Europeans to come to a negotiation with Russia about both Syria and about Ukraine.
Well, hasn't there been a direct flow of refugees through Russia from Syria, flying into Russia and then going up to Murmansk and then crossing into Finland and Norway?
I was in Helsinki slightly more than a month ago, and the refugees that are coming into Finland, they're coming from northern Lapland, in areas where essentially nobody lives. And they are Afghans that have been living in Russia for quite some time. So it appears as if Russia is simply dumping the substantial number of Afghans that have been living in Russia into Finland and Norway. But you're right, there are also Syrians who have been crossing over to Norway. And this raises a considerable confusion because both Norway and Finland trusted the Russians not to let anybody cross their borders without going through very tight controls. So this is intentional on the Russian side in order to cause trouble in these two countries.
So given that the head of NATO has come out and made these charges, and that it's been well known for some time that Putin has been supporting right-wing governments, particularly in Hungary, and right-wing parties in France, the Europeans must be aware of this. So do they know how much they're getting played?
Well, the question is, who are the Europeans? The European Union has now an extremely weak leadership. For example, the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker came out today and said that Ukraine will not become a member of the European Union or NATO for the next 20-25 years. And he has previously called for an end to the sanctions with Russia. And these are among the few public statements he does. And the foreign representative of the European Union, the Italian socialist Federica Mogherini, is very positive on Russia. So neither of these two people stand up against Russia. So the European Commission and the European Union as such is essentially out of it. So all the foreign policy we really see in Europe is now concentrated to Germany. And Germany has a coalition government of three parties, two conservative and one social democratic, and it's only Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats who are actually negative on Putin. Her right-wing allies, the Christian Socialists, are highly positive on Putin, and the Social Democrats are somewhere in between. So Europe doesn't really have any foreign policy standing apart from a couple of prominent German politicians. So as we speak, the German Minister of Finance, Wolfgang Schäuble, who has a very strong standing, has come out and said that we must not accept a division of Europe, but that's exactly what we are seeing.
And, of course, the British, Cameron, has been pretty outspoken against Putin and his activities in Syria, but because the UK has its problems with the so-called Brexit, does it not? I mean, that sort of diminishes their voice, doesn't it?
Indeed, since a referendum on Britain leaving the European Union started being discussed 4 or 5 years ago, Britain has effectively lost its voice within Europe. So the only thing that Britain really seems to be discussing in foreign policy, it is what attitude it should have to the European Union. So Britain is pretty much out of it. France is following Germany. And Italy has most of the time been in such bad financial shape and with such weak government so that it has not had a voice. Recently, though, under the socialist Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, Italy has raised its voice and then to a considerable extent against Germany, both when Germany is with and when Germany is against Russia.
So when General Philip Breedlove, the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, testified before the Senate a couple of days ago, he referred to the tactic that we've talked about, weaponizing the refugee crisis in order to break Europe, that he's charging, that Putin is orchestrating. And he said these indiscriminate weapons used by both Bashar al-Assad and the non-precision use of weapons by the Russian forces, I can't find any other reason for them other than to cause refugees to be on the move and make them someone else's problems. But curious enough, Russia's ambassador to London, Alexander Yakovenko, he basically acknowledged that there was a link, because on his social media page, he said that the ceasefire in Syria involving the Russian forces, which Putin has been energetically brokering, will, quoting the Russian ambassador to London, will help alleviate the migration crisis in the EU. So he's more or less admitting that there's a link.
Yeah, now Ambassador Yakovenko seems to be out of line in a hardline direction most of the time, but indeed that seems to be appreciated in Moscow. So clearly he doesn't get any reprimand. For example, the Russian embassy in London published quite atrocious racist caricatures against the Turks, showing big Russian soldiers beating small Turks. So this was quite strongly objected to, but evidently that was nothing that Moscow had any concern about. So what we are seeing now is that the official Russian spokesmen are very much in your face.
Well, again, one wonders, though, if they're in your face, then if you're a European leader, how could you not see it? What explains what would, I think, a lot of people would describe as appeasement?
Indeed, but this is the attitude in Europe. We are so weak, so we can't really stand up. After all, Europe spends only 1.3% of GDP on defense. The United States spends 3.5% of GDP on defense, almost three times as much. And then the U.S. defense is certainly far more efficiently organized, so that you get more bang for the dollar in U.S. Defense. And therefore, Europe today doesn't have foreign policy. It doesn't have a defense policy, and it doesn't have a defense. What we are seeing is that a few countries, essentially Britain and France, send their small but good troops to operate a little bit in various places. But this is not a serious defense, while the United States tends to lead from behind. The U.S. has the strength, but burned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the current administration is highly reluctant to deploy the force. And it's easy to understand why the Europeans would have to defend themselves, that I say as European.
Well, but when General Breedlove repeated to the Senate his concerns that Daesh, ISIS, can exploit this refugee crisis to send its fighters into Europe, as it did before the November Paris attacks, that's surely going to get the Europeans' attention, isn't it? I mean, if they...
Yeah, certainly it gets attention, but people are scared rather than acting. People here in the U.S. are afraid of people who join ISIS, but in France, about 3,000 Frenchmen have joined ISIS. In Sweden, it's about 300 people who are considered to have joined ISIS. And of course, these people are coming back. And as we saw with the French, the Paris attacks, there were people who had come in as refugees. And this is likely to get worse. And what we are seeing, as you rightly emphasize, is that President Putin is utilizing this in every regard. And unfortunately, the Europeans so far don't stand up, but rather get weaker as this is happening.
But what you're saying here, Anders Asland, is in effect a kind of geopolitical version of the Stockholm syndrome, where you identify with your torturer. In other words, Putin is torturing the Europeans, it's turning the screws so that they'll eventually relinquish sanctions against him. The people who are being tortured, the Europeans, by this flow of refugees and the possibility of terrorists being seeded amongst this flow, are essentially identifying with their torturer.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I think more that what we are seeing is something that looks like appeasement in the late 1930s when a bully is allowed to do one thing after the other because the other side, that is the Europeans, are so afraid of real war, so they are not prepared to stand up. Russia is not gaining any support in Europe. The Pew studies of opinion in Europe have shown that the anti-Russian feeling have risen and are very high indeed, up to 80% in a couple of countries like Poland and Sweden. So Russia enjoys no public support, popular support. While there are a few politicians who try to make deals with the Russians.
Well, one of them is Donald Trump.
indeed. So, I was about to say that.
Well, just in closing, Anders Asland, Russia itself, though, of course, for all of Putin's bluster and you have to at least give him credit to the extent that he plays a weak hand very strongly, whereas the U.S. plays a strong hand very weakly. But essentially, the sanctions that he's trying to get out from under are hurting, in my understanding. The price of oil is hurting him, and the fact that he and the Siloviki have stolen the country blind, and nobody, as far as I know, wants to invest in Russia anymore. So how bad are things at home in terms of the economy for Russia and for Putin?
It is pretty bad. Last year, the real wages in Russia fell by 10%, and that's a lot. 2 years ago, Russia's GDP was $2.1 trillion. Now it is almost exactly $1 trillion, about half. Most of this is a fall in the exchange rate. But when you measure international strength, you're really interested in the GDP at exchange rate and not purchasing power parity, which reflects the standard of living. So the Russian economy is now the 15th biggest economy in the world. So it's down there, and Russia is now not having a larger GDP than Mexico, which has approximately the same population as Russia. So Russia has become substantially impoverished by bad economic policies, by concentration on oil and falling oil prices, and the financial sanctions are quite strict and do not give Russia any way out of it. And my sense is that the sanctions will hold. Here in Washington, nobody's really questioning the sanctions seriously. And it's the U.S. sanctions that are important, because it's the financial sanctions that were imposed in July 2014. And that means that Russia does not have access to dollars, and all dollars go through New York during some stage in the transactions. And that means they go through one or three banks, Citi, JP Morgan, or Bank of New York, and they are perfectly transparent. So there we can see what is happening. And if somebody tries to cheat, as most recently Deutsche Bank, then you get exposed to massive fines that BNP Paribas paid, is it 2 years ago now, almost $9 billion in fines in the U.S. because they had violated American financial sanctions. So if the Europeans break the sanctions, it matters politically, but not in real terms.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.